Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's now 7 o'clock, and so it's time for me to open this hearing. My name is Kenneth Taylor, and I'm one of the panel of examining inspectors who have been appointed to examine, report, and make a recommendation to the Secretary of State for Transport on the application made by Highways England for the development consent order for the A303 Amesbury to Berwick Down road scheme. I will now ask the other members of the panel to introduce themselves.
Good evening, I'm Wendy McCarthy.
Good evening, I'm Edwin Maund.
Good evening, I'm David Richards.
Good evening, I'm Alan Nowitzki.
We are assisted at this hearing by the Planning Inspectorate case team. Today we have Mr. Richard Price, and he is assisted by Eva Sherman at the back. They will be pleased to help you with any procedural or other queries that you may have today. I will now explain some of the housekeeping arrangements for the meeting. In terms of acoustics, is the sound system operating effectively and can everyone hear me, including those at the back of the room, if you could indicate? Thank you very much. If any difficulties in that respect arise during the hearing, then do draw that to my attention or let the case team know. Please could you keep mobile phones switched off during the meeting so that the participants are not interrupted by them when they are speaking. I've been informed that there is no fire alarm testing scheduled during the meeting today. Therefore, if the fire alarm sounds, then it is likely to be for real. The building manager will check the panel and then inform us. And then we would leave by the nearest marked exit and not re-enter the building until you're instructed to do so by staff. The assembly point is by shop mobility. The toilet facilities, as you've probably noticed, are in the entrance lobby on the way in to the building. An audio recording will be made of today's proceedings, and this will be available on the National Infrastructure Planning website as soon as possible after the event. I need to make clear to you that because the digital recordings are retained and published, they form a public record that can contain your personal information and to which the general data protection regulations apply. The planning inspectorate's practice is to retain and publish recordings for a period of 5 years after the Secretary of State for Transport's decision on the development consent order. Therefore, it is important that you understand that if you participate in the hearing, you will be recorded and that you consent to the retention and publication of that digital recording. To avoid the need to edit the digital recording, the panel would ask that speakers try to avoid adding information to the public record that they would wish to be kept private and confidential. If it is genuinely considered necessary that there is no alternative other than to disclose such information, the panel will agree a process to allow that information to be provided and made available without forming part of the public record. If anyone present intends to use social media, report, film, or record these proceedings, then please do so responsibly and so that it does not disrupt the meeting. If it does disrupt the proceedings, then I will ask for it to stop. That applies to filming anyone who does not wish to be filmed. Does anyone intend to film the proceedings?
Sir, Reuben Taylor from Highways England. We have a camera that is set up, a camera relay to another room in the building, where I have members of the project team listening in. The camera focuses on the panel. It doesn't show any members of the public at all. And it's simply being provided so that the team can assist me in providing any necessary response to you today, and indeed to help provide responses more quickly in the future. So I hope that's satisfactory.
Thank you. Anybody else? Thank you. I would just remind anyone, if you are filming this meeting, then you are responsible for satisfying yourself that you're operating lawfully within the data protection regime. The only official record of the proceedings will be the audio recording that I have already mentioned. Other communications arising out of the meeting will not be accepted as evidence in the examination of this application. Can I ask participants today to come forward to the table at the front of the room when they are called to speak to the hearing? When you begin, please give your name and the organisation you're representing, if any. And please speak clearly into the microphone when you're making your contribution so that it can be recorded accurately. Can I check if anyone from the press is present? If there is anyone, then could you please make yourself known to the case team, and they would, and any press queries should be made to the planning inspectorate's communications officer, and the case team can provide contact information if that is necessary. We will be proceeding as explained in Annex E to the Rule 8 letter dated the 11th of April 2019, which gave notification of this open floor hearing and provided a link to an indicative agenda. The open floor hearing provides an opportunity for interested parties to make their oral submissions to the panel. It also gives the panel the opportunity to ask speakers questions about the evidence that they have presented. Oral submissions should be based on previously made written to those previously made in writing by participants. However, we have already read those submissions and they will be afforded the same weight as those made orally. Therefore, what we are looking for is not for those written submissions to be repeated, but instead this should be an opportunity to provide further detail and explanation to help us understand and fully appreciate the case you are seeking to make. The procedure that we will follow today is to hear first from the interested parties who have notified us in advance of the meeting that they wish to speak. They will be invited to come forward in order to give evidence. As indicated in the agenda, to make the best use of the available hearing time, we will allow each interested party a maximum of 5 minutes for their oral submission. We do have the discretion to allow people to continue beyond that maximum time period if we consider that will be a benefit to the examination, but we advise you not to rely upon that discretion being exercised and to stick to the time limit as best you can. The panel may then wish to ask the speaker questions. The applicant will be given an opportunity to briefly respond to any matters raised by each speaker or in summary at the close of each session. I will ask for those present not to interrupt whilst a person is given evidence, even though you may agree or disagree strongly with what is being said. It is important that everybody has a fair opportunity to put their case without interruption or other distraction. Government guidance for the examination of applications for development consent explains that the examining authority may refuse to hear evidence which is, in its view, irrelevant, vexatious, or frivolous, relates to the merits of a national policy statement, or repeats other representations already made, or relates to compensation for compulsory acquisition of land or an interest in or over land. Additionally, the examining authority may request a person behaving in a disruptive manner to leave the hearing or remain only if that person complies with specific conditions. I have a list of those who have indicated that they will be speaking today, and they will be called to give evidence in the following order. So David Hassett first, then Janice Hassett, Tom Holland, Frank Summers, Andy Rindtut, I believe on behalf of Tim Tatton Brown, in place of. Thank you. If there is anyone else in attendance who wishes to make submissions, then we do have the discretion to hear any further submissions if time permits. Is anyone else wishing to make submissions? Who will be speaking for the applicant today?
So I will be. My name is Reuben Taylor, QC, I'm instructed to appear today on behalf of Highways England.
And will you be speaking in summary at the end of the session?
Yes, sir.
So could I invite the first speaker to come forward? So Mr. Hassett, please. If you come forward to the table and there is a button on the front of the microphone, if you press that, and please introduce yourself first.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the examining authority. My name is David Hassett, and I wish to speak representing Shrewton Parish Council. The statement I will be making has been agreed and endorsed by this Shrewton Parish Council, as indicating the majority view of the residents of the village of Shrewton. Shrewton Parish Council endorse Highways England's proposal for the A303 Amesbury to Berwick Down Stonehenge scheme. The current single carriageway A303 is operating at over 84% of its calculated capacity on a daily basis, and during bank holiday periods and for the August holiday period this year, rises to over 120%, with westbound traffic queuing for nearly 5 miles back from West Amesbury, with journey times of this distance taking up to 2¾ hours. The situation is virtually identical for eastbound traffic. There is daily reference to this traffic congestion and extended journey times for this section of the A303 on local radio. This inevitably leads to traffic diverting off the A303, with all the alternative routes, bar none, transiting Shrewton via the four roads that converge on the village, with the two B roads being that narrow that footpaths are barely in evidence. The traffic volumes we are talking about are well above what one would describe as reasonable, and have been supported by the Atkins Traffic Routing Survey carried out in 2014. This indicated recent statistics from a speed indicating device traffic counter on one of these B roads coming into Shrewton, and this is just one way, showed approximately 1,900 vehicles passing in one day, where in the 1980s, one would have reasonably expected 200. The closure of the short section of the A344 that ran past the Stonehenge Monument in June 2013 has only exaggerated the rat-running situation that we have at Shrewton. This road carried approximately 8,000 vehicles in either direction and was a direct link between the A303 and the A360, which runs through our village. And it would be fatuous to imply that the road's closure would not have an effect on local traffic. Community Speed Watches in team in Shrewton consistently report 100 plus vehicles passing in their half-hour monitoring sessions, which underlines the traffic issues that we have. In addition, we have little respite from the length of time the rat-running traffic transits our village. Easter Monday 2019, eastbound vehicles diverting off the A303 at Winterbourne Stoke started to come through Shrewton at approximately 09:30, and this continued until 2300, more than 13 hours later. Highways England have identified this issue and highlighted this in their objective summary, and also correctly focused on the issue of accidents and air quality. It is in this context that we feel our village's situation is being overlooked, not, I hasten to add, by Highways England, but by certain objectors to the scheme who claim, without even anecdotal evidence, let alone empirical, that irreparable damage will be done to the hitherto undiscovered archaeology or even the World Heritage Site itself. This, in our considered view, is distorted and consistently overlooks the obvious broader issues that I have outlined. That's my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you could stay, and the panel may have questions for you. I just have one initial question. You've mentioned the community speed watch sessions. Just approximately, how often do you hold those?
Well, we have a small team, and currently it is approximately 10 people. We switch between the two community speed watches between Berwick St. James, which is one of our adjacent villages, and ourselves. So every other fortnight, we get ours. And there are, I would say, 16 sessions of half an hour each. And I don't want Mr. Taylor to presuppose what the figures are, but there's, in usual terms, a 25% to 30% increase in speed, over and above what we call the quartile. We only measured the traffic in one direction, but we're experiencing speeds in average over 37 miles an hour in the 30 mile an hour limit, and our most recent roadside recorded one was 54 miles an hour on a road that's only 6 metres wide.
Okay.
What might be said is that speeding is a matter for the relevant enforcement authority. Is there a response you'd like to make to that?
The difficulty basically is that Wiltshire Police are very much under-resourced to deal with this speeding issue. So we're obliged to, we're a group of volunteers on the Community Speed Watch, and we pass the responses to Wiltshire Police, and within their limited resource, they do come and support us, but it's not very often.
And in terms of positioning of your traffic counter, could you just tell me exactly where it was, the road it was on, and the location?
Yep, the particular one that we're talking about is on the B3086 London Road. We now are in a position where we have two speed indicator devices, one of which is for the traffic heading westward and the other one for the traffic heading eastward. They have the facility to both record speeds and do a traffic count. Having said that, I do beg your pardon, these speed indicator devices are circulated around various locations within the village, but predominantly they tend to be on the B3086, which is the road that has the biggest problem, because this is the primary rat running route.
I think also we heard from an interested party yesterday, or perhaps at some point yesterday, suggesting that perhaps the Shrewton villagers, parish council, may have been misled by the benefits that the scheme would achieve, and rat running would still take place, notwithstanding the road improvement. For example, perhaps when the road or the tunnel was closed for maintenance, or when high vehicles were using the route option for those types of vehicles. Is there anything you want to comment on that?
Well, I think on that basis, it's a perfectly legitimate point. We do appreciate, using the American analogy of there's no gain without pain. Having said that, part and parcel of the Highways England scheme relates to the reprofiling of Rolleston Cross, which I'm pretty sure you're aware of. We have a situation whereby currently the Packway, which is the road that runs from Lark Hill, is a straight run through on what's known as a Totso on the B3086, which runs from Airman's Corner. The sat navs on vehicles tend to say alternative route, and they come down that way. With the reprofiling of the Rolleston Crossroads to curve the vehicular traffic down towards Airman's Corner, this would be, of a considerable help. We do appreciate there that during the course of the actual process of building the whole road scheme, that we are going to suffer. In the long term, one would expect that if the Rolleston Crossroads were made a priority on the actual first part of the scheme, that vehicles which during the course of the, let's presuppose many years in the future there, that the tunnel is closed for maintenance, would be sent down towards the A360 and then they could transit the village on what is part of Wiltshire's freight route, although it's not actually on the strategic freight network. This would be a considerable improvement on sending vehicles on a very narrow B road with no pavements.
I think just one final question. The latest traffic analysis report, I believe, covered the Easter period and showed quite a significantly increase in traffic compared to the longer one that was conducted over the winter period. Is there anything you want to say to me about the frequency and nature of the difficulties you've described that the village is experiencing?
Not really. It is a consistent seven-day issue, particularly on London Road. When I moved into the village in 1991, yes, there was an issue of rat running, which tended to occur Friday, Saturday, and there was a brief respite, and then it would repeat, in the opposite direction on the Sunday. We're now finding that it is happening 7 days a week, and it is starting to build up on Thursday, runs almost continuously right through Sunday into Monday, and there are significant peaks at bank holiday weekends, Easter, so on. Curiously enough, the only quiet time is Christmas Day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mrs. Hassett, could you now come forward, please? If you could start by stating your name and who you represent, please. If you just push the turn the button first.
Evening, Madam Chair, gentlemen of the panel. My name is Janice Hassett and I'm the founder of Stonehenge Traffic Action Group, STAG for short. The campaign was set up in 2013 to fix the Stonehenge section of the A303, which is now over capacity by 84%. This increase has caused traffic to run through local villages as drivers follow sat navs to avoid the continued queues. And who can blame them? I wouldn't want to sit in that queue sometimes upwards of 1.5 hours for 7 miles. I presented a petition to Parliament in July 2014 because arguably our village of Shrewton, which lies to the west, just outside the World Heritage Site and 2 miles from the monument, suffers most from this rat run traffic. Our speed watch team regularly register upwards of 40 miles per hour. During Easter, a speed indicator device was installed in both directions on London Road, which is referred to before, from 9th of April to the 24th of April. And it's all on this sheet here. This is the actual sheet that came off the machine. It registers 78 miles per hour within the 30 mile per hour limit confines of the village at 22:25 hours on the 15th of April. The speed device is situated at just one of the four entries to our village, and the figures make interesting reading. In just 15 days, this is over Easter, it told us that 67,030 vehicles used the London Road entry point, and that equates to 4,403 per day average on just one of our roads. All of the traffic has to use either our High Street or Tanner's Lane, neither of which are suitable for this continued traffic. Cobb cottages are suffering as a result, and there is a paucity of pavements in the village. We have elderly, mothers with children, dog walkers, cyclists, horse riders, all trying to go about their daily lives and having to avoid nose-to-tail traffic, aggressiveness, poor air quality, and litter thrown from vehicles. Madam Chair, may I point out that the majority of the people objecting to this project don't live in our village and very often live 80 plus miles from the problem. Some even live in other countries and other continents. Here are some of my own facts for the naysayers. Firstly, the tunnel will be some 400 metres. This will vary, obviously, as the land undulates. Some 400 metres south of the monument is not going under the monument, as has been suggested. Secondly, the tunnel roof will be some 22 metres from ground surface. That's the height of two normal-sized two-storey houses built on top of one another. Thirdly, yes, during construction, there will be very likely some disturbance to archaeology at the portals east and west, but the tunnel will be 50 metres underground, and as I've said many times, I'm not aware that we bury our dead that deep. Whilst we appreciate fixing the A303 around Stonehenge will create disruption for us all, and in fact will probably unearth further archaeology, would this be a bad thing? Since there is undiscovered archaeology all over the UK, life must evolve and find new artefacts, maybe to the good. I'm certain that archaeologists from Highways England, work closely with National Trust Archaeologists and Heritage England, have come together to find common ground, and the changes will be carried out appropriately and sympathetically, in a sympathetic manner, opening up the route to assist the economy of the West Country, whilst returning the land to nature and wildlife, giving us back our village. Putting the 303 into a tunnel will achieve all of this, and there is no reason why there cannot be a balance between the living and the dead. That's the end.
Thank you very much. The traffic monitoring information that you've submitted focuses on London Road, and you've mentioned there are three other routes into the village. Could you just explain the situation that occurs on those other routes and why your focus was on London Road?
London Road is chosen to install the SIDS because there are houses still further, they're out of the village, but they're still part of the village. And there are no pavements to take the people down into the village. There's a left-hand bend on London Road. It's very dangerous. And with no pavements, they have to get down to the school, to the doctors, and to the shop, all the people who live in that stretch of houses on London Road. And it's extremely dangerous. So that is why I think the SID is installed there, though they can be moved around the village, I gather.
And just approximately how many houses are on that part of London Road?
There are about 12, I think, 12 families live along there, all with young children.
You made reference to some cottages that were suffering, but I didn't catch the name.
Oh, it was just Cobb cottages. We know what they're built with, Cobb.
Oh, sorry.
Manufacturing process.
And are they on London Road? Is that?
No, when I said that, it was mentioned as Tanner's Lane. There's a number of Cobb cottages in the village itself, but Tanner's Lane will suffer from rat run traffic, and the Cobb cottages can't take it any longer.
And is the concern there because of the nature of the Cobb construction as opposed to other?
Yeah, that's the main problem there.
Can I just inquire about the accident record in the area?
Oh, figures. Did you want figures?
Well, if you have them to hand,
if you can tell me anecdotally. I can get some for the inspectorate panel. Do you mean actually in the village?
Well, yes. I mean, if we take, for instance, from the point that you're measuring on the London Road going into the village.
Okay.
And a reasonable distance outside. But do you have an idea anecdotally of what accidents have occurred?
In as much as no one has been seriously injured so far.
Yeah.
That I'm aware of. A number of years ago, there was a gentleman killed in our high street by an American driver who had hired a car.
Sorry, could you say that again?
A number of years ago, 2003, this goes back to.
Yeah.
There was a gentleman killed on the high street by a tourist. I assume he was a tourist because it was an American driving a hired car. Now, that was a death. Yeah. Other than that, what we've had are minor comes together. You know, there was in one instance, a gentleman was locked between two facing vehicles. He was trying to cross the road, an elderly gentleman.
Yes.
And he got trapped between the two vehicles.
Yes, yeah.
So that's the kind of thing we're getting.
Okay. In your summary, your written summary that you put in, if there are any details that you can add, that will be helpful.
Yes, I can try and find that out for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. If I could call Mr. Tom Holland, please. And again, if you could introduce yourself and who you're speaking on behalf of first, that would be helpful.
Thank you very much for hearing me. My name is Tom Holland. I'm a historian, and I am president of the Stonehenge Alliance, a group that has been running since 2001, has been revitalized by the development of this planning proposal. And we have presented 10 written representations to you. I am aware that it's not my role to go through them, so I will simply mention that our primary focus is opposing the damage that we think this tunnel will do, damage to the archaeological integrity of the World Heritage Site, damage to the bird life, damage to the water table, damage to the international reputation of Britain as a signatory to UNESCO, therefore legally mandated to uphold the integrity of World Heritage Sites, and the damage that this will potentially do to World Heritage Sites around the world if Britain is seen to ride roughshod over this treaty to insert gashes of tarmac and concrete into a World Heritage Site. We are very concerned about the international implications of this as well as the local. But of course, we are 100% aware of the local implications. We are aware of the damage and the difficulty that the narrowness of the A303 past Stonehenge provides, particularly for locals. I am regularly using that road on a Friday evening, so I'm aware of the traffic. However, although we are concerned with conservation, we are also familiar with the accountancy of this, with the issues of traffic. So we have made representations about that as well. We've been working with organizations that by no stretch of the imagination could be described as hippies, as tree huggers. So last year we contributed to a report issued by the Taxpayers Alliance, who stated many planned road transport improvements that could be done more quickly in the south of England and southwest, which would be of greater benefit to commuters across the region. In other words, their anxiety was that this tunnel promises to be a massive white elephant, a judgment that seems to have been substantially validated this week, as you will be aware, with the ruling of the National Audit Office. And we feel as well that this scheme simply doesn't work in transport terms, as Andy Reintart, who is sitting there, former mayor of Amesbury, president of the Salisbury Chamber of Commerce. So again, you know, this is not a herbivorous muesli muncher. This is a man totally familiar with the transport and with the business issues, has said that drawing on Highways England's own figures, that the tunnel will save just 4.8 seconds per mile on an average 100-mile journey. But I'm going to be upfront. I'm going to speak now in personally, why I have taken on this role, why it matters to me so much. I grew up in Salisbury. Stonehenge means an enormous amount to me personally, but it matters to me and to people. It's been complained that people from around the world are concerned about this, but people around the world are concerned about this because this is not a normal place. This is not, by, you know, this is a unique site, and the uniqueness of it can be expressed, I think, in terms of the different perspectives of time that we need to keep in our heads. So I mentioned the 4.8 seconds per mile on an average 100-mile journey that the tunnel will expedite. But we need to keep in mind that at Stonehenge, uniquely, we're dealing not in terms of seconds, we are dealing in terms of centuries and we're dealing in terms of millennia. So I want to give you three dates to keep in mind. Let's go back to the 7th century. A decapitated body found dating from that period is the earliest evidence we have that English speakers viewed this site as something sacred, as something holy, as something mysterious. Then we go back 2,000, 3,000, the building of this site. This is an unfathomable distance of time from us. But we can still go back further. We can go back further. The gap between us and the building of the stone circle, even further than that, if we go back to 7,500 BC, we are getting animal remains from a site at Blickmead, right next to where the eastern portal will be, with all the threat to the hydrology that has preserved these organic finds. These are finds that point not just to the origins of Stonehenge, but to the origins of continuous society in this island. And the point of this is that Stonehenge does not exist in isolation. It is part of the most precious, the most significant prehistoric landscape, not just in Britain, but probably in Europe. Mrs. Hassett said correctly that there is undiscovered archaeology all over England. But the significance uniquely of this stretch and why it has been declared a World Heritage Site is that the archaeology contributes to an overall organic understanding of our past that is incomparable. There is nothing like it in this country. And so for that reason, I'm aware that I'm speaking in a language that doesn't necessarily gel with talk of rat runs and so on. But I believe that if this scheme goes ahead, it will be a desecration that will cause people in centuries, maybe millennia's time, to shake their heads in disbelief that we allowed it to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Holland.
Mr. Holland, do you have any comments to make about wider connections to Stonehenge? There is evidence of cultural links from well beyond Stonehenge, and your theme seems to be the importance nationally of it. But
yes.
Can you point to indications which might confirm those links?
There are traces of animal remains from the Stonehenge landscape that seem to have come from Scotland. So that is a huge distance. At Blickmead, you know, this incredibly ancient site, which points to the beginnings of settled existence in this island. You know, this is a time when Britain wasn't even an island. We have evidence of a dog that came from Yorkshire. So, of course, we have the stones that come from Wales. This is a pan-British site. And what is fascinating about this is that one of the very earliest references to Stonehenge, Geoffrey of Monmouth, he describes this as, you know, this is the giant's dance, and he describes it, the stones, as coming from Ireland. Well, we don't have evidence of contacts with Ireland, but what we do have is evidence of contacts from across this island of Great Britain. And so this is a site that is not just about for people who live in Wiltshire, it's not just for people who live in England, it's a British site.
Yeah. I understand that, and it is remarkable the international connections that are made as well, but is this not true of many other sites within this country and across the continent? There was a lot of migration, for instance, in search of by hunters searching out red deer in hunter-gatherer times, that kind of thing. There are a lot of links of trade routes from the Mediterranean and the Middle East. I'm just a little worried that we might be attributing some element of uniqueness in the of wider influence to Stonehenge, which actually occurred generally in prehistoric times.
Well, I mean, what is unique about Stonehenge is the fact that it has survived and on the scale that it currently exists. You are, of course, absolutely right that the patterns of migration, the patterns of settlement, the patterns of construction of stone circles are something that is evident across across Britain. However, the point of why the Stonehenge landscape in its entirety matters, and why this is not just of national but of international significance, is that it is the coexistence of all these various sites in the one landscape. The fact that we don't even know what is there. There are kind of known unknowns, if I may coin a phrase. And those known unknowns, in the context of Blickmead, for instance, are that we now know that there is organic matter all along there, waiting to be found, that will enable people to understand the beginnings of settled life in Britain, but therefore, by extension, the beginnings of life across Europe. And if the tunnel goes in, if it turns out that the issues with the hydrology are as serious as hydrologists are suggesting, then that organic matter that is lying there buried and undiscovered will have gone, and we will never find it.
Yes, I mean, in a way, that's our task to judge whether there is a risk to the hydrology of Blickmead or anywhere else. And we have to see what evidence, we have to look in detail, probe in detail at the evidence in the environmental statement reports and take it from there. But, you know, there is the view as well that we're now in a better position than ever with the techniques that we have to discover more and more. And carefully done, a scheme like this could yield quite a wealth of knowledge. And the point is that it has to be done carefully, and we have to be convinced that the mitigation that is embodied in the scheme is adequate.
Of course, absolutely. And essentially what I'm doing sitting here is to emphasize the stakes that are in play when it comes to your decision, because the thing is that you, if you decide to green light this scheme, we'll never know whether you were right or wrong. We'll never know what we might have discovered if it turns out that this organic matter vanishes and is destroyed. I on a purely personal level, and again this is something that perhaps is unusual to be heard at a kind of meeting like this. But for me, it is a sacred site. The sacrality of this landscape, you know, there may have been sites like this all over Britain. The point is that around Stonehenge, it has survived in its totality. And so this is a site that has been sacred to people. We know since 7,500 BC, maybe even older. So that is almost 10,000 years it's been sacred, it's been holy. And the prospect that we face is that the legacy that we leave subsequent generations will be the desecration of a landscape that has stood intact effectively for 10,000 years. And the legacy to our generation will be a 100-year-old an injection of concrete and tarmac into the sacred landscape that will have a lifespan of at most 100 years.
Well, I mean, I say again that it's our job really to make sure that desecration doesn't take place, and we are very aware of that responsibility. But also, in a sense, what this scheme does, if it's carefully considered, is to lay down another layer of history in a way. In the way that the layering of civilizations occurred in prehistory, and the Romans were involved as well, and so on. So that carefully done, we may be leaving our own legacy for the future.
We will certainly be leaving our legacy for the future, and that is exactly my concern. To reiterate, the significance of this landscape is precisely that it does not have the kind of intrusive development that marks other regions of Britain where there were prehistoric landscapes. Those landscapes have largely gone. They've vanished beneath the plough, they've vanished beneath concrete, they've vanished beneath cityscapes. Uniquely here, we have something precious. If it is decided that the legacy we are going to leave subsequent generations is going to be a vast, intrusive road scheme, then I would regret that profoundly, which is why I'm sitting here.
Yeah. Did the Romans fully respect what they found?
In what sense?
Did they preserve what was there? Did they develop around it rather than over it? Did they clear it away?
the Romans did not, we don't know what the Romans thought about Stonehenge. They don't seem to have mentioned it, but they clearly did not destroy it because it's still standing there.
Mm. But there are Roman remains, and you don't know what those remains have taken the place of.
Well, what we know is that this has been a site that has been sacred, not just since the Neolithic, but into through the Roman period, into the Anglo-Saxon period, into the medieval period. The well at Amesbury, which with the mysterious waters, with their quality of turning stones pink. This is something that was clearly of immense sacral value to people in the Middle Ages. It was seen as a holy well. It was also clearly a place that was holy through the Anglo-Saxon period, into the Roman period, into the Iron Age. And because Blickmead is right next to it, we have to assume that this is a sacred place that goes all the way back to the Mesolithic. I mean, that is what makes it incomparable. If you have a place that has been sacred, not just over the course of centuries, but over millennia, it seems to me that paying some degree of respect to that sense of sacrality is it kind of makes sense.
Yes, well, we don't disagree on that at all. You know, we will be paying that respect, and that's part of the testing that we'll be doing.
And I very much hope you will.
And, you know, just as an aside, I believe it was in the 18th century that Blickmead was actually drained, that most of the alteration in hydrology occurred. Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Holland, you've referred about, in your view, it's a sacred site and your concern about harm to that. Could I just understand your view of the effect you think that the existing A303, its proximity and the levels of traffic has on the site?
It's obviously not ideal. A road has been running past Stonehenge for many centuries. So in that sense, the A303 is a continuation of a road that's been there for many centuries. But obviously, I would love to see it moved. And if speaking personally, not on behalf of the Alliance here, I would, if there was an option of a tunnel that went under the whole of the World Heritage Site, I would leap at that. I would absolutely welcome that. My issue with the plan is that as it stands, it will desecrate what is as important to our understanding of the site as the stones themselves. It seems to me that what is risked is the equivalent of, you know, cattle ranchers moving into a rainforest and leveling most of it and leaving a tiny little island in the middle that preserves no sense of the vastness and of what existed before. That seems to me the risk with this.
Thank you.
You've probably already given the answer in response to my colleagues, but I just wanted to make absolutely clear, I have heard your reference to the sacred nature of the site, and then you also commented on, the welcoming of a tunnel that went right the way through the World Heritage Site. So really, I was just wanting to break down, as it were, your particular and specific concerns with this particular scheme. We obviously understand the hydrology issue and Blickmead and those sort of things, but perhaps leaving that to one side, as it were, are there particular aspects of the scheme that cause you specific concerns in terms of the impact on the sacred nature of the World Heritage Site?
I think that it's my concern is on two levels. The first is for the archaeology. So Blickmead is, I think, the most sensitive site, the site that's most in danger, but there are risks to the archaeology on the western side as well. But it is also, and again, here I speak personally, I don't speak for the Alliance, this is a personal matter for me. I think that the intrusion of portals, the intrusion of feeder roads, the widening of the dual carriageway across this landscape seems to me unconscionable. that any government could even contemplate it.
You made reference to a report that you'd commissioned or been jointly responsible for from the taxpayers.
No, I contributed to rather than right. with the Taxpayers Alliance.
Yes. Has that been submitted to us?
I'm not aware if the Taxpayers Alliance have submitted it.
Okay. Are you intending then to provide that
if
as evidence?
If they haven't, I will chase them.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm just trying to get clear in my own mind. Comments you've just made in about the archaeology and the hydrology, but you're supportive of a longer tunnel. So if the shorter tunnel might have an adverse effect on the hydrology, wouldn't the longer tunnel do the same?
I am not remotely an engineer nor a hydrologist, so I'm sure that I may have got this wrong, but my understanding is that the risk of to the water table consists in the building of the portal and the link roads where it is directly adjacent to Blakemead.
Thank you, Mr. Holland.
Thank you.
Could we have Mr. Frank Summers, please? And again, could you introduce yourself and if you're representing anybody first?
I believe this is still on. It is. My name is Frank Summers. I'm representing the Amesbury Druids. And I guess the future generations of my tradition. I'm very much in favour of alleviating the traffic problems that the local people have in the area, but I'm concerned about the means. And my coming to speak to you today is really to make you aware of two of my concerns. The method of alleviating the problem, I perhaps doubt that this is the right approach with the tunnel as proposed. I confess I'm not local. I have a long involvement with Stonehenge and the Amesbury community that started for me in 2003 and with Amesbury in 2010, but I live in East Hampshire. I have led ceremony in Stonehenge. I was involved in having the Druid religion recognised in English and Welsh law in 2010 and overturning a Roman banning on us that was set out in, I think, AD 42. The position I take is really one that's prehistoric and in the origins of our traditions, and the other one, it relates to the future. And I haven't pre-prepared what I was going to say. The previous speaker was very articulate about Blakemead. It's fair to say that the Druid tradition, as documented by historians, is a Roman and Greek account of things that took place in the Iron Age whilst the Druids were a bloody nuisance to Roman expansion in Europe. And some accounts are positive and some are negative. But the origins of the Druids that by then had spread right across northwest Europe into the Balkans are unknown, and the dating is unknown. What I would say about our Western tradition is it's as powerful and as complete and as mysterious and wonderful as anything you would find in the Vedic tales or the Abrahamic traditions or any of the other great world traditions, but it's not taught in our schools and it is dying. If you read the Irish and the Welsh folklores together, there are great tomes of information. I became fascinated in my 20s whilst an IT student in Wales, and I found beneath the stories of fairies and heroes and other realms was a subtext of balance with nature, how to be positive within your life, what the role of man and woman is in society, an honour system, and very many valuable things that helped shape me over the years until eventually I decided I wanted to be a Druid to transmit these traditions and make sure they don't die out. Something very lost in the modern age. And then I encountered Amesbury and I realised that there would be no future for the... I'm not talking about a new age dancing around tree-hugging. I'm talking about the deep spirituality and understanding of the lessons that our ancestors left for us. And attaching that to your spirituality in everyday life. This is dying out fast. And I wanted to give it some life in a real community. And while Andy was mayor, he very kindly invited me to take part in some things that were going on. And I have to say, it's probably the first time in my life that I've experienced a community of many different traditions, but largely Anglican and very middle class, giving me a chance to take part in community affairs like the carnival and various other things going on. I represented Amesbury in part to Her Majesty the Queen in 2012, which was the first time I think a head of state, who's also head of the Anglican Church, shook the hands of a Druid. And I've taken part in the digs at Blickmead. And I've also attended the digs of Professors Wainwright and Darville, I think in 2008, and Mike Parker Pearson's digs. So I've followed a story where archaeology has been telling a joined up period of use in the Stonehenge landscape that starts in the early Mesolithic, practically post-Ice Age tundra times and hunter-gathering, through to a handover and an overlap of cultures into the Neolithic, the development of Stonehenge, its disuse, its move through Bronze Ages and Iron Ages. And in Wainwright and Darville's study, they found plant evidence that probably local people had been celebrating the winter solstice at Stonehenge covertly, right forwards from the disuse of Stonehenge, or the official disuse of Stonehenge, and the 1750s, when the paper record for tradition starts. So for me, there's no way to prove when some of our folk traditions have their origins, but certainly people would have had to have known each other to pass down ideas over a long trail of time. And Blickmead is giving us the earliest possible taproot. And just to tweak your interest, if you throw money into a wishing well, you're following a Druid tradition that we can date to the Iron Age and pre-Roman periods. The Romans also used to do that. If you touch wood when you have a bad thought, that's a Druid tradition. In fact, celebrating Christmas is a Druid tradition in its origins. It's the birth of the sun, was related to the birth of the Son of God. So these things are important. Now, if you go to Blickmead, there's a causeway into what would have been a small lake. And there are what appear to be unused, perfect flint works, tens of thousands of them. And what doesn't come out in the media is that these things seem to be unused. So the perfect little flint naps have been deposited into a pond with a causeway, with all the attributes of a sacred place that you would have recognized if it was Iron Age or late Roman period, or my daughter today throwing money into a wishing well. And that's an intriguing connection for me, given the passage of time.
You've gone a little over your 5 minutes, so
I
if
apologize.
You could wind up, please.
If I can make my remaining point, today, every winter solstice, we run a lantern parade on winter solstice eve with members of the community. We process into Blickmead and we hold a Druid mixed faith ceremony there. And the community has attached what they perceive to be an ancient meaning to a modern community across all faith groups, and attached it to Blickmead as a centre of community identity. And to us as a Druids, that gives us a modern day purpose and meaning and role in society. I believe that if any work scheme affected the water table and those springs were to die up, we'd lose both our possible discovery of our earliest origins through the archaeology and perhaps our future, because it's a very tenuous link that we have to the real world as Druids. And we have this at Amesbury, and for us this is unique. If the spring goes, we've really lost a great sacred place. It isn't everybody's belief, but the Druids believe that nature and people and mountains and lakes, everything shares the spirit and is part of the great creation. And at Blickmead, that sense of comradery with spirits of present day and past seems to be very prevalent, and we regard that as sacred.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you could just stay there, sir, we may have some questions for you.
Okay.
If I just have one question. If you could just explain, in a little more detail, your personal use of the World Heritage Site, how you interact with it, be that Stonehenge or the wider landscape, including.
Yeah. I think in 2007 or 2008. I sort of came out in my Druid robes and started work at Stonehenge, primarily to try and have a more sensible message reach the public eye, because they only see the cameras seek out the stoned hippies, and you know, they ask what's the winter solstice all about or the summer solstice all about, and get a load of garble come out. And that was really to the deficit of the wider pagan community who had a deeply held spiritual belief. So I went there to try and change the message and to stop the alcoholism and drug abuse. I led ceremony there in 2008. I was involved in getting the ancestor statue from Amesbury into Stonehenge to try and sort of up the energy a bit in 2010. So I've held ceremony. I've tried to bring spiritual meaning to what otherwise is quite a chaotic gathering, although that has meaning too for a lot of people. I can tell you that the current A303 doesn't disturb celebrations. You can't hear it at all when you're in circle or on the near confines. You can proceed perfectly normally. Although it does divide the landscape, so do the current fencings and rules of prohibition about access for spiritual purpose anyway. I use Blickmead as a sanctuary. I was married at Blickmead. My daughter was named at Blickmead. And I've taken part in the archaeology at Blickmead. And each year, bar one, so far, I've led the Amesbury Winter Solstice Lantern Parade and Druid Ceremony there. I would regard it as our centre of our sacred grove, because the ancestors of the ancestors sprung from there. It's our taproot. I would be tearful if I couldn't think of my daughter going there with her children and maybe naming her children there. I think it's very special to the people of Amesbury, this united people. It's certainly very special to us. If the water table goes and the spring disappears, it will lose an essential part of its character. It'll just be a glassy field, bit muddy. And it won't be the same. I think you've seen it yourselves. It's quite a sanctuary at the moment.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Just one additional question from me. I've understood the concern you've raised about the potential impact on the water table and its potential effect on Blickmead. Do you have other concerns with the scheme? And I just want to understand what those are and how, in your view, that would harm the way that you interact.
The interaction with the World Heritage Site as a whole is difficult. There's few pathways and points of access. I mean, the steerage everybody believes is go through the visitor centre and you know, pay your turnstile thing. If you genuinely want to walk from Amesbury or cycle, or even the Amesbury people process from their town to Stonehenge, it's virtually impossible. You'd have to negotiate main roads, walk through private land. You can't follow the old avenue. And one of the things I'd hoped for the scheme was that there would be cycleways or pathways inobtrusively put across the landscape, maybe along the route of the old A303 when it was removed. I don't see much evidence of the access side being taken care of. The other concern, which you'd probably regard as quite esoteric, but we believe that there is a ley line or an energy flow that goes between Salisbury, Old Sarum and Stonehenge. I dowse, and I wasn't sure about this legend, so I went and dowsed that area, and there does appear to be something. I don't believe there's been any research into the effects of such maybe geomagnetic energy flows of putting a large steel-reinforced tube under the ground in their path. There may be none, but our concern would be, is that part of the magic that you experience when you're in Stonehenge is generated from that flow of energy across the landscape? I'm not pretending to understand if that is an issue or not, but I just do think it should be looked into.
Thank you. You've just mentioned there a concern about continued access via foot and cycle, and just wanted to understand if you had reviewed Highways England's documents and as to what is proposed in terms of access in part over the existing A303.
Up until about 6 months ago, I'd registered as an interested party and was receiving documents, and then things went into their second phase and contact from Highways England discontinued. I have been actively going along to their open presentation days that they've held and viewed the maps, and I've had conversations with Copper Consultancy and Highways England representatives, including hydrologists as well, and walked the landscape with them and explained that the pagan community actually feels, I'm not talking about the free festival types, I'm talking about the pagan community, feel actually quite excluded and unwelcome, and that the tourist trumps us on every occasion. If there was a circular walk where there were places where you could put down, there were maybe some, you know, wooden totems at the east, west, south and north points from which you could still see Stonehenge, and informal gatherings could be held without disturbing anybody and still be part of that landscape. Most pagans don't walk that much and explore the burrows and the alignments or walk along the avenue we mainly, because our access is so restricted to four short windows of time each year, you bust in, bust out, observed by security, you try to pack in your spirituality and you're off. Personally, I do visit the landscape informally, though.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, I just want to understand how you consider, if you do at all, that the proposal before us would change that, because I understand what you're saying in terms of you feel there's a restricted access now, but so I just need to be clear if you feel there would be any additional harm or even a benefit from the scheme in that regard.
There was a potential to create benefit for access from the scheme if, as part of the multi-billion pound investment, a few hundreds of thousands were put into small places to park on the periphery, on the outside of the landscape, and walkways in. I know there are some informal routes in via Woodhenge, but there is no processional way accessible from Amesbury with any degree of ease without crossing the road. When the road is grassed over, it's archaeologically neutral, and there would be possibilities then of putting a pathway and maybe some picnic spots along there. I don't know. I wouldn't want to further damage the landscape visually or you know, encourage the wrong types of use, but the possibility, I don't believe, has been properly explored to open it up. I think rather it's making it more exclusive. It's paying tourists and archaeological access only, and there won't be much freedom to roam and enjoy and explore as the brochures kind of portray.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just following on for that, I just wondered if you're aware that part of the proposal is to convert the surface of the existing A303 to a what's called a restricted byway, which basically means a route for pedestrians, horse riders, carriage drivers, collectively known as non-motorised users, along the route of the A303.
So because I haven't been updated recently.
So
on my last update, that wasn't in the plan originally about a year ago, and it's one of the things I suggested we could maybe think of, so I had that in mind. So I'm glad to hear that.
Well, it does form part of the scheme now, and,
okay,
and that would
great.
Go some way. I'm not saying for a minute it would satisfy all your concerns, but
no, it would mitigate some. My main concern today is that the cuttings and deep preparations near to Blickmead would damage Blickmead, and Blickmead is fundamentally precious. We can't replicate it. We can't just move on and take. There's a cultural taproot of something beginning again there, and also this ancientness that you just can't replicate. So if you found a way, and the hydrology was an exact science, and we had enough data to say that risk is mitigated, there will be no impact, that would go some way to easing my concerns. At the moment, I don't think we have that level of understanding about the hydrology of the area, or even hydrology as a science, just from doing boreholes and moving. And I have to say, one of the boreholes went right through the archaeology, which I was a little bit displeased about.
Yeah, that's probably been mentioned. That was drawn to our attention when
okay,
we went on the site visit. And that is likely to be explored at a further issue.
There's one, hearing. If I may, just one last point. Previous speaker mentioned the Romans and Stonehenge. The Romans in Britain mentioned the genus loci. Genus loci, I believe that's the spirit of place in Latin. They respected it and feared it, which is why Britannia was referred to as Britannia, as a Romanized name for the spirit of the land. They generally built their temples and repurposed or dual purposed them on ancient sacred sites as well. And I think they had the means to take down Stonehenge if it offended them. So just that little addition, I think, is worth noting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Summers, one of my colleagues does have a.
Well, first, stay put. This may be the final one, I'm not sure.
Okay.
We've highlighted to other speakers in the earlier sessions that during the process we wrote questions to interested parties, and one of those was in respect of people who feel they have a spiritual connection or an interest in the site, and we've asked them to explain in more detail that connection and why they feel that connection. So again, I would invite you to explain that as much as you can for us so we can understand it fully. We've deadline 3, which is next Friday, is a time that we'd ask you
right.
to do that if you're able.
I'd be happy to try. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think you did mention it, but I didn't catch it properly. But the could you just go through again the first evidence of Druid activity?
Yeah, so it's hotly disputed. The written evidence of a Druid's, let's just define a Druid. A Druid is the priest and educationary and judicial class of Celtic society. The earliest written evidence, folkloric evidence, is the Book of the Duncow, which I believe was written down at the end of the 5th or early 6th century in Ireland. We have similar folklore in the Mabinogion of Wales, and more recently collected stories from, you know, basically old fishing villages and things around the British Isles. It's a bit of a hobby in Victorian England to go around and collect obscure tales. We have the survival of the Brehon legal system that was practiced in Ireland until the 1750s and actually quite respected. And we have the Celtic triads, and of course we've got Tacitus, Pliny, and those various antiquarians talking about the Druids. Historians tend to say there's not much known about them, but if you take them in context of what you know about Celtic society, their beliefs, their festivals, I can tell you, before ever there was the thing called an archaeologist, just from telling the tales of Tara and the heroes there, you could say they lived in roundhouses, had great duns on hilltops, fought, wore bronze armour, worshipped at Beltane and Samhain or Halloween and May Day, who their gods were, what their values were, what their ethics were, and what their beliefs about the meaning of the earth was. And so we do know quite a bit.
Yeah. So is Tacitus the earliest reference?
I'm not sure who the earliest classical historian is, but that's where the paper trail dries up. Yeah. But they were by then already in the upper echelons of society, I believe all the way from Tuscany through Gaul, some parts of Germany, into the Balkans, and Caesar, I believe, mentions that the Druids started in the United Kingdom, or the Britannic Isles, which referred to us. So it does seem like something started here. It takes a long time for an idea to spread that far and embed itself through society. So some germ of an idea that started in Britain spread across Europe and caught their imaginations. And we don't know when that started or where, but it might conceivably be Blickmead.
Yeah, okay, so you're suggesting that the origin was in Britain?
Well, I'm saying that the classic historians suggested that it was in Britain.
Okay. And the continuity of your beliefs and rituals, how continuous, how strong a stream
so
has this been?
Well, funnily enough, if you go back to beyond classical, you know, the modern religions that are about 2,000 years old or less, globally there's a lot of continuity of religion and practice, not costume or language, but religion and practice around the world, of which it seems the Western tradition is a part. The continuity, I would say, I probably wouldn't recognise the language, the clothing, or maybe even some of the ritual practices of an Iron Age Druid, let alone if they existed before that, when they might not recognise me, but we might be standing in the same places at the same time of year for the same intentioned reasons. And I think in that regards, things have been quite consistent. And as I say, the idea of making offerings and regarding springs as being a sacred place, and seeking out the wild places to commune with the gods or commune with one's own spirit, these are things that are starting to turn up in prehistoric archaeology, which is what fascinates me and draws me to that aspect of it. But I don't believe our ancestors were lying. And I've started to make a study of South American traditions and other traditions around the world, and I'm finding an awful lot of synergy, which by pure random chance shouldn't be there. Another thing is, of course, by the time Stonehenge was built, it contained an awful lot of astronomical knowledge, which you would imagine would take many generations to build up. And maybe that came from the hunter-gatherers. Yeah. It's all question marks. I really don't know the origin, but I believe we're only just embarking on this sort of holistic exploration of this, and it'd be a shame to be stopped in our tracks now.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. You're now free to go.
Thank you for your time and letting me run over.
Okay, Mr. Ryan Tutt, please. Again, if you could introduce yourself first of all and who you're speaking on behalf of in this case.
Thank you and good evening. And my name is Andy Ryan Tutt. And for the benefit of this particular presentation by me, I just want to let you know that I've worked in and around the highways industry for 37 years. I've served as the chairman of the Institution of Lighting Engineers in 2003-04. I was the operations director for the largest road lighting maintenance contract in England from 2001 to 2006. Having had the great pleasure of joining you on the site visit on Tuesday and attending the hearings yesterday, I wish to speak to you tonight regarding the concerns I have regarding the lack of detail and clarity that has been presented by Highways England over the past couple days and in their documentation regarding traffic movement, rat running, contraflows, and lighting within the World Heritage Site. Whilst I appreciate that road junctions can now be designed without street lighting, there is an exception when it comes to changing lanes in contraflow situations. On expressways, such as the proposed A303, there will be a high number of advanced warning signs required to indicate such changes in speed and direction of flow, especially where a 60 mile an hour dual carriageway has to filter into one lane and cross the central reservation. And may I refer you to the Traffic Signs Manual, Chapter 8, Part 1, which I'm hopeful the Highways Engineer, Highways England QC, Reuben Taylor, will also refer to in detail in any of his responses. With this in mind, I have constantly questioned how Highways England could continue to tell us and you that there will be no lighting within the World Heritage Site. I believe yesterday, sirs and madam, one of you pointed out to a speaker that you were also of the view there would be no lighting within the World Heritage Site. Earlier in the week, I challenged the highways engineer regarding lighting for contraflows and was informed that the contraflows would indeed need lighting. However, it was not a problem as this was temporary lighting and it would be situated outside of the World Heritage Site and therefore would not cause any problem with the Stonehenge sunsets, the alignments at midwinter, which gathers an enormous amount of publicity and participation by the public, particularly near the Western Portal. If the highways engineer is correct and the planned contraflow where traffic is sent from one side of the dual carriageway to the other side of the dual carriageway to enable the closing of one of the tunnel portals for maintenance or attention is outside of the World Heritage Site, then this must mean that the contraflow on the westbound will be situated beyond the proposed Long Barrow grade-separated junctions. If the contraflow is beyond the Long Barrow junctions, may I ask you how you think the traffic travelling westbound will access Shrewton, the A360, which is Long Barrow Junction, the Stonehenge Visitor Centre, or the Army Camp at Lark Hill, when they will not be able to exit the Long Barrow Junction because they will be on the opposite side of the dual carriageway. Sirs and madam, this is a fundamental design flaw and must be addressed by Highways England in cooperation with Wiltshire Council. I don't believe there is enough length in the road between Long Barrow and the tunnel to put in a contraflow within the World Heritage Site. And if there is, it will be lit. If it is not, then we have a serious traffic problem in the surrounding road villages and in particular Shrewton, because the only way to get back to the visitor centre will be to head all the way out to Wylie and come all the way back through the villages, or turn round. Please may I therefore request that Highways England show us how they propose to address this and arrange for a site visit to see firsthand the routes they propose that will be used in the event of diversions. May I also suggest the representatives from Shrewton, who have been convinced that this scheme will remove their traffic woes, are included in this site visit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One initial point for me. We ask that people, or that people have the opportunity to do a summary of their written submission by the next deadline free, because you've raised some quite detailed points. I would really encourage you to do that, and it may well be that if you annotate a diagram to highlight some of the concerns, which would allow Highways England to respond and understand what you're saying. And then my question is, you referred to a guidance document, and I didn't have the opportunity to fully take that down. Could you repeat what that was, please?
I certainly can. It's the Traffic Signs Manual. It's Chapter 8, Part 1, which is the use of signage and lighting when you have temporary contraflow and changes in traffic flows on dual carriageways and expressways.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that brings us to the close of the listed speakers I had. Before I ask the applicant to make any contributions, I just wanted to check that no one else intended to speak. If I could invite the applicant to come forward then, please. Thank you.
So rather than approach, can I simply indicate that I don't have any further representations to make? The fact that I'm not making any response is not intended to be any discourtesy to anybody who's presented to you this evening, nor is it to be taken as acceptance of what was said.
Thank you very much. So if there are no other matters that anyone wishes to raise, I shall now close this hearing. I thank you all for your attendance and participation in this meeting. The hearing is now closed.